Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Iran has surpassed its low-enriched uranium stockpile limit, violating the terms of a 2015 agreement. What do analysts say?
They're looking for a way to get some economic relief to gain some leverage.
Also, a day after demonstrators in Hong Kong stormed the city's Legislative Council building in protest over an extradition bill, China responds. And the Department of Homeland Security is investigating a Facebook group with alleged racist posts from U.S. Border Patrol agents. These stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. Iran announced on Monday that it has exceeded its low-enriched uranium stockpile limit, violating the amount it agreed to hold in the 2015 international deal. The move is aimed at forcing the signatories of the nuclear deal to give Iran relief from U.S. sanctions. VOA's Kurdish service discussed the consequences of Iran's actions with two experts on Iranian issues, and Zlatissa Hoke has this report.
Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif said Monday that Iran is acting according to its rights stipulated in the international agreement, which the Trump administration abandoned last year.
Iran has crossed 300 kilogram limit, as we've announced earlier. We said very clearly what we were going to do and are acting on it. We consider it our right based on the international agreement.
Iranian leaders are trying to gain leverage in their struggle to get relief from U.S.-imposed sanctions, said analyst Catherine Bauer.
They're not necessarily looking for a way to export their low-enriched uranium. They're looking for a way to get some economic relief, to gain some leverage. And hopefully that means they want to re-enter negotiations, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
The Trump administration has imposed tough economic sanctions on Iran to cripple its economy and force it to agree to renegotiating the nuclear deal that U.S. President Donald Trump considers inadequate. Iran is not likely to do that in the near future, says analyst Alan Makovsky.
I think that Iran has the wherewithal that they will not do that, certainly not under the Trump administration. I think they're hoping Trump will be defeated in 2020 and perhaps they'll get a fresh start.
Makovsky says it would be a major loss of face for Tehran to return to negotiations. Iran is more likely to engage in provocations, such as arming Houthi rebels in Yemen and staging attacks through third parties.
Using proxies is one of Iran's most preferred ways of responding to sanctions and to other policies of the United States which it objects, because use of proxies gives them a certain plausible deniability.
Both Iran and the United States have said they do not want war. U.S. President Donald Trump has been pressured by those who want a military response to Iran's provocations and those who urge de-escalation. He says he is in no hurry to respond.
The sanctions are on, and I'm in no rush. I'm in no rush with Iran. I'm never in a rush. If you're in a rush, you get yourself in trouble.
Analysts say it is not clear if and when the sanctions will produce the desired effect. Makovsky pointed out that Iraq under Saddam Hussein had been able to hold out. North Korea has carried out 6 nuclear arms tests despite years of international sanctions. Zlatissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
China is condemning Monday's violent protests in Hong Kong as an outright challenge to the one country, two systems formula under which the autonomous city is ruled by the mainland. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets on the 22nd anniversary of Hong Kong's reunification with China, and scores of them broke into the city's legislative building. The break-in ended after riot police arrived on the scene and used tear gas to disperse protesters. Now in the studio to bring us the full story is Raymond Yam from VOA's Cantonese service. Welcome, Raymond.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So it's no surprise that China came out in opposition to the protests in Hong Kong. Can you say a little bit about what Beijing was delivering a message to those individuals?
Well, Beijing just tried to act tough and make sure that this demonstration or the resistance will diminish, or maybe probably in their hopeful wishing that they will no longer exist. But I really doubt it, especially for the, as you can see, the demonstrators, they are quite energetic and they are willing to continue to fight for it.
Well, yes, yeah, so we should be noting that this is all over an extradition bill that Carrie Lam,
yes,
the legislative leader in Hong Kong, mm-hmm, has temporarily pulled back. But we've seen months of protests,
yep,
and millions of people out on the streets.
People are very angry because Carrie Lam never officially withdraw the bill, and this is what people are talking about, withdraw officially instead of pause or maybe retreat, whatever they name it. And at the same time, remember there was a police crackdown in June 12th. That's a lot of people get injured, and it also make a lot of people in Hong Kong get angry. And so this demonstrator, when they occupy the Legislative Council, there's one of the demands that they would like the government to set up the independent commission to do the investigation, especially for the police excessive forces brutality. But unfortunately, the government, led by Carrie Lam, they refuse to listen and to make any promise. And so as the demonstrator also warned the government promised they are not going to prosecute all the individuals that they arrested since June 12th. Unfortunately, the government still get their death year and they refuse to make any promise. So that's why make people angry about it. And that's why you see the demonstration and the resistance keep fighting and keep going on.
So if we take a look at those who are demonstrating, who went inside the Legislative Council,
yep,
building, what's next for them? Because that is being treated as a crime scene.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of people, a lot of demonstrators, they believe that there's no way for them to go because they already try a lot of efforts. They try the demonstration, they try the petition, they try to do it peacefully. But seems like the government refused to answer any single of the questions. And they claim that this is their own way to fight and to get government or in the international community attention about what they are concerned. And so I will say this, this time, because there is no real leader for this resistance, everybody just go through the social media to communicate and make a decision. They even make a vote to decide what's the next action. And so there, at this moment, it's quite radio silent and no one know what they are going to do. Maybe they are going to take like 1 or 2 days breaks and then there will be another situation happen.
Thank you very much. Raymond Yam is a reporter with VOA's Cantonese service. Thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Here are some other major stories from around the globe. Ethiopia has begun restoring internet access 10 days after it was cut following the assassinations of 6 top government officials. The internet shutdown affected the entire country. Experts say the sudden summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un arose out of their common desire for perpetuating the illusion of denuclearization, even though their divergent definitions of the term remain unchanged. Monsoon rains cause walls collapses that killed 27 people in India Tuesday as a second day of bad weather disrupted rail and air traffic in the financial capital, Mumbai. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and with our mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of planetary scientists at the University of California, Santa Cruz, completed an analysis of metallic or M-type asteroids. Their findings led them to propose that some of the solar system's metallic asteroids may have had volcanoes that erupted with liquid iron after its crust had cooled and solidified shortly after their creation. The scientists say that these metallic asteroids were formed quite early in the solar system's history during the early stages of planet formation. It's thought that any serious collision between these developing planets would peel away their rocky outer layers, leaving behind its liquid iron core floating in space. The scientists say they were prompted to conduct their study in part by NASA's proposed 2022 launch of a probe that will investigate Psyche, the solar system's largest metallic asteroid. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Department of Homeland Security is investigating a report that current and former U.S. Border Patrol agents are a part of a Facebook group posting racist, sexist, and violent posts about migrants and Latin American lawmakers. The ProPublica investigative site says the posts include sexually explicit images and remarks mocking migrant deaths, including the highly publicized death of a Salvadoran man and his 2-year-old daughter who drowned in a river. Joining me on the phone with more on this story is VOA immigration reporter Victoria Maki. Hello, Victoria.
Hey there, how are you?
I'm okay. Can you kind of give us a brief breakdown as what is exactly going on with this Facebook group?
Yeah, this was not a great look for Customs and Border Protection in recent days. Obviously, they've been under a lot of scrutiny just in general in recent weeks, especially over treatment of detained migrants along the southwest U.S. border. And so yesterday, ProPublica broke this story. They gained access to some screenshots from a Facebook group. I think there was around 9,000 or 10,000 members. Some of them, they were able to vet and find out that they were, in fact, members of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And, yeah, the images, the comments, there's some very lewd stuff in there. It's pretty gross, to be honest.
What are the officials in the Borders and Customs Patrol Agency saying in response to the reporting?
Right. So their response, I mean, obviously they had to condemn this, and they did quickly. They issued a statement. The head of U.S. Border Patrol, Carla Provost, made a statement saying, you know, this is not going to be tolerated. You can't talk about people. You can't talk about other human beings, whether they're lawmakers or migrants. You can't do this. So they have launched an investigation. I suspect it's not going to be a quick turnaround. These investigations do take a bit of time, so I don't think we'll have any answers in the coming day or two or even a week. But, the investigations internally are usually pretty thorough, and there's usually a fairly lengthy report that comes out. So at some point, we'll have some more details on exactly what they find out about their own staff members.
You mentioned that Customs and Border Patrol came out very quickly condemning this action. What has been the response from those up on Capitol Hill and the White House?
So the timing was super interesting. There were some Democratic lawmakers and some high-profile ones at that, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who were down visiting some facilities yesterday. So it was a whirlwind of stories. But, Democrats especially have been so keen to put a microscope on what's been happening in these border facilities that when this story came out, they sort of took it as like, okay, this is just more proof of what we've been saying, that we're functioning in a corrupt system. We are seeing abuses both, verbally and online and in person. So it's sort of reinforced what they've been saying for some time.
We have about 30 seconds left. Moving forward, does this look to change anything going on at where those who are crossing the border are being held?
Oh, goodness. I wish I could tell you that, we would see some improvements soon. By all accounts, it's not great for anybody to be detained under any circumstances. I don't suspect we'll have any resolution in the very short term to this, other than maybe a few more porta potties, maybe a few more showers, but nothing substantive.
Victoria Maki reports on immigration issues for VOA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Sudanese opposition coalition has called for more protests after Sunday's deadly protests. The opposition says Sudan's transitional military council should be held responsible for the deaths of 10 protesters reportedly killed by security forces Sunday. The government blames the protesters for the deaths. The exact number cannot be independently confirmed. Journalist Michael Atit is in Khartoum and reports that opposition representatives are calling on citizens to hold mass protests for the next 2 weeks. They are to be followed by 2 days of civil disobedience on July 13th and 14th. Also today, officials in the United Arab Emirates urged the military council, which replaced President Omar al-Bashir in April, to continue to hold a dialogue with the protesters. The UAE foreign minister urged both sides to avoid violence. The protesters are demanding a civilian government. At last week's G20 Economic Summit, President Donald Trump and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, sat down to talk on the sidelines of the summit and joked about journalists in front of a room packed with journalists. President Trump said, "Get rid of them. Fake news is a great term, isn't it? You don't have this problem in Russia, but we do." President Putin responded, "We also have. In English, it's the same." President Trump routinely describes journalists as the enemy of the people, an expression first common in world literature and a century ago popularized by Russian autocrat Vladimir Lenin. Courtney Radaj, advocacy director with the Committee to Protect Journalists, tells International Edition's Lori London that the president's comments put journalists' lives at risk.
I mean, it's just shocking for the president of the United States to joke with the president of Russia about fake news and to basically denigrate journalists. With a president of a country that is among the worst abusers of press freedom and journalists in the world. There are journalists behind bars in Russia. There are many journalists who have been killed in Russia. So of the 58 journalists that have been killed in Russia since we began keeping records in 1992, 38 of them were targeted for murder. And nearly all of them have been murdered with impunity. There's no effort to investigate the murder of journalists. Meanwhile, you have the president of the United States joking around about something that is having a real impact on journalists in Russia, where, you know, we report on a, you know, daily and weekly basis about the threats and dangers that journalists in Russia are facing.
Even beyond Russia, the president has basically called news here in the United States that he doesn't like fake news. He even went so far as to say something pertaining to a New York Times article that it was a virtual act of treason. That's a crime that could lead to a death penalty.
Yeah, we've really seen the president of the United States ratchet up his rhetoric against the press. And it seems to be part of a concerted strategy to undermine the press as well as to denigrate and pillory the press at a time when they are already under threat, and as an effort to inculcate himself against criticism or any sort of independent or critical reporting. And we actually did an analysis of his Twitter feed, and we found that the rhetoric that he has used since he became a candidate has kind of gone from the pillorying and singling out of individual journalists and media to the fake news trope and the constant battering of media and journalists as fake news, which then, of course, ricocheted and took off around the world. And then more recently transitioned to including the use of the term enemy of the people, which harkens back to Stalinist and Maoist times. And at least 11% of his tweets during the period that we analyzed were anti-press or some targeting journalists. And this is really disturbing. I think that when you start, you know, bandying about things like enemy of the people and treason, it sends a very dangerous signal, not only to journalists in the United States, but also to journalists around the world. And the other thing that it's important to point out is that when he made that comment to President Putin, it was the anniversary of the deadliest attack on American journalists in history since we began keeping records, the anniversary of the Capitol Gazette shooting. And that is no joking matter. We have heard from journalists around the country that they have had to up their security, that they have had to invest in security systems, panic buttons, glass windows, security guards, trauma training for their staff, all of these sort of things, which come at a time when it's a very economically challenging time for the media. And so now they're having to put more money towards security. And you add this to the fact that in the United States, according to the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, where we track these issues in the United States systematically, and kind of public gatherings, demonstrations, political rallies are the most dangerous times for journalists. So you have a constellation of factors that are creating really dangerous conditions for journalists right now. We've already seen two political rallies where journalists were attacked. Some of the Antifa protesters attack a journalist. It sends a signal, regardless of what political side you're on, that it's somehow okay to attack and denigrate the press, which is actually a fundamental theory of democracy.
That was Courtney Radaj, advocacy director with the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking to my VOA colleague, Lori London. And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence unexpectedly visited the White House Tuesday. White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman spoke with VOA's Jim Bertel about that visit.
We're aware of some situation, it's unclear what it is, that has compelled the Vice President of the United States to cancel or cut short a trip to New Hampshire and rush back to Washington. The Vice President is here in the White House. When we pressed the Deputy Senior White House Press Secretary Hogan Gidley about what's going on, whether this is something of a national security nature or a political crisis or something personal, all he would reply is something came up. He says he won't clarify at this time what this involves, but says that there is no cause for concern. And when a group of reporters outside his office said, well, we are concerned, he said there's no cause for it and there's nothing to worry about. The vice president, as of noon Eastern Daylight Time, was back in the White House. It's unclear whether he's meeting with the president. We're also assured that the vice president was not summoned back to Washington because of any problem with the president. And that's about all we know at this moment.
So has there been increased activity at the White House? Anything to indicate something big is going on?
No, I did notice some of the president's personal detail, the Secret Service, just outside the colonnade, meaning that the president's most likely in the Oval Office and that there may be other people in there as well. But we're not on any sort of lockdown here at the White House, and we're not aware of any sort of national security crisis, not even rumors of anything of that nature that have been going around that would indicate any sort of imminent military activity. So it's just a big mystery right now, but of course, this is an unusual situation.
That was VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman with our own Jim Bertel. Today, in just a short while, the U.S. women's national team will be taking on England in a semifinal match as the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup rolls toward completion. Both teams won their respective groups during the first round of play in the tournament, with the Americans securing 22 goals thus far in this year's World Cup. While much of France is experiencing a heat wave, thunderstorms have rolled into Lyon, dropping temperatures down to the mid-20s Celsius. Last time the two teams faced each other, the match ended in a 2-2 draw, but in 2007, in a quarterfinal match, the Americans came out on top 3-0. The U.S. women's team is the favorite to win the game this afternoon, but don't count out England, a team that has the tendency to rise to any occasion. But to secure this victory, they will need to play at their absolute best. The game gets underway at 1900 hours UTC. And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer Thomas Blondet, thank you so much for joining us. And if you would like to have pictures, videos, stories, and more of what's going on in the world around you, be sure to follow Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Tuesday.